You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Benjamin Weissman, whose first collection of short fiction, Dear Dead Person, has just been published by High Risk Books, a division of Serpent's Tail. Oh, well, given the theme song, which praises human beings for being animals that think, reason, and read, it leads me to your own fiction where human beings are other kinds of animals. I wondered what attracts you to the animal and brutal nature of the human.
You know, we kill and eat and then, you know, have sex a lot and basic stuff.
Does the subject matter of the fiction matter to you? Because when I was going through the collection, I found myself thinking that the events in the stories provide occasions for extraordinary uses of language, a lot of surprises, but that the anxiety invoked by the material itself is there to inspire the writer to his craziest kind of linguistic creativity.
Well, I mean, I think that the writing of the stories is like a formal problem, or, you know, pushing and pushing and putting pressure on sentences to sort of get them to be peculiar and surprising and maybe begin at point A and end up at Q or somewhere where I didn't really expect them to go. But I might, you know, write stories that I want to read or stories that I don't really see anywhere. You know, and I like reading about sex and I like reading about violence. I enjoy the Metro section. And I like, you know, crime stories and Scorsese and...
In terms, though, of the style of the stories, it's almost as if while the stories themselves have high levels of violence, a man is sexually and violently involved with the head of a decapitated child, for instance, that the language itself doesn't come from violence so much as from childhood, certain kinds of cartoonish, zany vaudeville routines, that this is not really the naturalistic rendering of, you know, the violence of man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I like to throw myself into situations or try to maybe think about how I could perfect a moment or a situation where it would be really horrific. And I guess I like to sort of, you know, make something kind of beautiful out of something horrifying. So it would be kind of unexpected to have delicate moments. You know, when a murderer worries about eating or worries about stains and or, you know, their clothes or haircut, like that they still have to do these things. And I get pretty excited by, you know, the details off the subject, but off the subject of the actual sort of killing. But I mean, I don't know what to say really about the language, except that I want it to be kind of rich and pushed farther than banal conversation.
You started writing fiction per se at CalArts, and I wondered to what extent does that aesthetic, the aesthetics of the ugly or the grotesque and angry, come from art school? After all, Michael Kelly was another student there at the time. Is this an art stance?
Not really. I mean, I probably am more into like Edna Buchanan, you know, or somebody who, you know, and John Hawkes, and I mean, or writers. I mean, really, they were not that. They were, all art schools are very interested in writing and or claim to be, but they really are mainly interested in theory. So the only real writer any art school cares about is Baudrillard. they don't want to talk about anybody else ever. You know, and when I was in school, Walter Benjamin was more popular, and he was actually worth everyone's attention. But I don't really think that. No, I don't really think that there's, you know, even Mike really didn't deal too much with violent stuff when he was there. He's much more sort of scientific and, I don't know, sociological and systems and all kinds of other things. He's, you know, really brilliant in these other areas. And so I really don't think, I mean, you know, rock and roll bands maybe are more of a standard for art schools, you know, and for artists who are having a hard time making the pictures they're making.
Well, you know, when I first met you and I saw your collection of books, which was, you know, for a bookworm, a very peak moment in a friendship, they were arranged not according to author and not according to category, but according to the color of the spines. All the books with black spines were in one place, with brightly colored ones in another. And it made me think that the stories, too, have a certain disregard for the contents, that to some extent the content doesn't matter. It's the, I'm not trying to remove the stories from their horror, but I'm trying to suggest that what makes the horror interesting is an indifference to the horror.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I kind of think that they're just sort of like formal problems to work out. I mean, I think that, you know, the violence in itself is kind of boring, you know. It's kind of mundane and quick, and it really needs like a lush treatment to have any kind of life. And either some, you know, detailing some kind of emotion or detailing a total lack of it. I mean, both are kind of, you know, worthwhile. But, yeah, my books aren't arranged that way anymore. But I know that was weird. Friends would come over and they'd be like, this is disturbing, or that's really beautiful, or something. I don't know. I fetished them too much, and I never really read a book until I was like 20. So when I started to get into books, I got into them like a really very wildly, absurdly, and I would get hundreds of books at a time sometimes in used bookstores and just pile them in and throw them in my wherever I lived, and I just wanted them to be surround me. And you know, I might read, you know, one out of five, you know, and they would, so there's still all these books all around the place. I wonder what, you know, I don't know what Sister Carrie's like. I can't wait to read it. Or I wonder what The Bulwarks by some guy is like. And you know, I don't know.
It was interesting because back then, too, there were occasional books that were wrapped up. I think you bought them, got them wrapped as presents, and just put them around, and you wouldn't necessarily remember what was in them, nor, on the other hand, would you open them. And that reminds me very much of the style of some of these stories, not to be insistent about it, but that suddenly, in the midst of a context you think you know, will come a murderer's announcing that he very much likes vinyl because the stains can be washed off it, or strange and sudden announcements of personal preference on the part of otherwise deranged narrators whose derangement is usually signaled by these odd human moments instead of by the intensity of the violence or their strange quests. So it's as if in their normal moments these people become most disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the formal problems that you talk about include the lengths of paragraphs? Some of these very short stories are written in one entire block of prose. And in what kind of problem does that solve?
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of like to have a kind of controlled confusion, maybe. Or I mean, also part of this is like my total love for Thomas Bernhardt. So I feel like I always want to write stories that are one paragraph, because out of like, just like, I want to endlessly, like, you know, kiss him for being like my total idol and being so great, and you know, like he's everything. But I mean, I want a certain kind of confusion, or that's not confused or confusion, but that's something that's a little bit like of the head or in the head or in, or more like that a story or a big chunk of a very long paragraph is like a piece of consciousness, and that it doesn't really have the uniformity of paragraph breaks, that it kind of, things kind of go into each other. And I like sentences to do that too, not a run-on necessarily, but something where... you begin, like I was saying, at A and end at Q. Like, what? You know, should that be two sentences? These are two separate ideas. And I kind of like it if the ideas kind of smear a little.
Can you tell the listeners about Thomas Bernhardt?
Well, I mean, you know, he was... I don't really know how to, you know, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, he was a Nazi youth. He grew up in Austria. He is... probably also Austria's, he died about 5 years ago. He's Austria's greatest writer. He's also one of Austria's most hated writers, and his meanness is so profound and funny. He's got one of the oddest senses of humor. He brutalizes a lot of people and subjects and things, but he takes himself down the farthest. So he's got a great sense of, his self-loathing is really hilarious and beautiful. And I really adore that he, no matter who he's going to, you know, kind of slap around, he's always going to do something pretty hard to himself too. And I think that's really fair. And I think he's great to his audience, and he's a great, you know, son of a great, you know, thing to come after Samuel Beckett, and so I don't know. I like his meanness so much. I think that's what really, and then it's so amusing. But he, you know, is he tries a lot of people's patience, and a lot of Germans are like, I can't believe this would be translatable and that you would like it. How is it possible? But when you go to Germany or Austria, it's so exciting because everyone there reads him and knows him and loves him, and or at least artists and writers do. Older people hate him and want him, you know, want him assassinated, or you know, but he died on his own anyway. And a lot of the conservatives think that he died of, you know, he died of throat cancer, and people felt like he died of being so mean, of being a vicious, like, speaker and writer. And because a lot of his things have a real autobiographical edge, you know, thing to it, and he really attacked the government a lot.
I'm speaking to Benjamin Weissman, the author of the collection Dear Dead Person from Serpent's Tail. At the other pole of your admirations, there's Robert Falzer, who seems to me, as opposed to the brutalities of Thomas Bernhardt, to be a melancholy and teeny writer of minute and morbid sensitivity. He died in an insane asylum, having given up writing. His handwriting was microscopic and looks a lot on the page like an array of bugs' antennae. Could you speak a bit about Valser?
Yeah, he also totally floors me. And I know, I mean, I ended up, you know, writing, my handwriting is like really like microscopic, you know, or got tinier and tinier the more I knew about him, you know. And it's stupid, you know, but you just fall for it. It's like when you fall in love with somebody, you just, you know, you end up, you know, you both wear stripes all day or whatever. I don't know. It's, you just get out of your mind. And but he really taught me, at least, you know, that you could write a story about anything. That was what was so cool about him, that he really, he was like the Kafka writer who no one ever knew about, you know. And
he, in fact, was an influence on Kafka.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they were saying that Kafka was Valzerian or whatever. And yeah, I just really liked that he could write a story about a button and pay tribute to a button on a shirt and say, like, and just go on and on about, you know, that kind of thing. I just thought, like, you're so, that's out of your mind to be able to do that and do it really well and convincing. And, or, you know, he just was really willing. He could make a lot of boring things really, really fantastic. And he has his moments where maybe he's a little too sweet. too adorable, but I'm really, you know, Jacob von Gutten about, you know, a school for butlers, you know, is awesome.
It's funny because I tend to think, I don't want to subsume you in, you know, two figures, but just rather to use them representatively as a sample polarity. It seems as if the Voser side is the side of tenderness that makes in your fiction for a kind of sweetness which, unlike Voser, because of the context of violence and brutality, becomes not cute or not sentimental, but sudden, jarring, and weirdly moving. I cite in these instances, though, things that are again part of an anti-aesthetic, a love of the smell of dung or gasoline or the gritty texture of, you know, muddy pebbles, a whole series of cadenzas about physical functions. I wondered, does it become fun to make these things into pretty toys?
For sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, the whole fun principle is really important, you know. I mean, I want to have a really good time when I'm writing, and I want to, like, you know, I'm not a comedian, but I really want to, like, crack myself up, and, you know, and I'd rather, like, shoot for something like that than other types of, you know, profundity or something. But, I mean, he, you know, also Barthelme was really huge for me. I think I kind of outgrew him, but he was, you know, gigantic. I think that he really related. He was close to the wall, to the Bernhardt thing. And I think they all kind of swirl around together, where language is the sort of primary thing, and a single sentence kind of dictates the next one. And there's a kind of strange logic to, you know, the way things happen, and that it's about, like, really interior kind of writing, and it's books that could never be made into a film, because there's nothing, you know, it's mostly in your head, and it's sort of nice that you know writers like that are very safe from being destroyed by movie people.
All of the writers that we're talking about here in different ways have problematic relationships to novel writing. Kafka didn't want his novels published. Weirdly, although Voser wrote several novels, most of them have not been translated. The one that was translated is out of print, and what he's known for are these short pieces. Barthelme, too, although he wrote two novels, was scared of them. And Bernhardt, because these pieces are prolonged paragraphs, although I don't think, except in one book, that he wrote short stories, he wrote plays too, there is the odd feeling of things always in the middle, of having just started, that this is all not a novel, but a paragraph here. It just happens to be 120 pages long. How do you feel about novel writing and your own future in that regard?
I know. I'm supposed to write one. I mean, there's a gun pointed at my head to write a novel. I mean, even my book of stories was rejected earlier, you know, years before, and everyone was like, you have to turn this into a novel. It is a novel, so make it one. Smear it up and make it one. Go away and come back with one, you know. And so, you know, I was like, I won't do that, but, you know, I think they're stories. But I would like to try to write one. I'll try and write one. I'll force myself. I think I can. It's really hard, you know, to keep. I like the stories to be intense and lots of, and these things happening, and I like it to have a real, you know, particular sort of fury or energy, and so it's hard to maintain that for 100-something pages, and I think a lot of people do it great.
Who are the novelists who managed to do that?
Well, I think, John Hawkes is obviously, you know, great from beginning to end, and Dennis Cooper every second, and Bernard Cooper, or there's so many people who kick ass. I can't really. I'm just trying to think of other novels that. Dennis Johnson. I would guess his story is more than the novel.
Beckett.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, and yeah, I can't. I'm blanking on all the other greats.
Now, I'm curious, when you have, as you do in several stories, subjects like rape, incest, extreme sexual violence, how do you answer objections to the content itself if you're not feeling completely contemptuous of the person raising the question? How do you speak of the disturbance of the material?
Well, I don't really know how to. I can't help somebody screwed up about something like that. I'm horrified by the situations too. I mean, you know, and I think that I'm compelled by being frightened to sort of work on subjects like this, but I also know that, like, guys who do things like this and kill people or rape people or whatever also have a certain kind of giddiness about what they do, or a kind of particular pleasure, or that, it's a variety, it's just a huge thing. I'm not an apologist for them. I'm sort of just curious about what kind of occurs. And I also know that, I remember, you know, growing up in different times in high school being like so insane and watching my friends get insaner and wilder and being really cruel and wild and thinking, gee, what do I do? Do I start smashing people up too, or do I like go walk on the grass and lie down and just say, I don't think I can be friends with you anymore?
And speaking to Benjamin Weissman, the author of the collection Dear Dead Person from High Risk Books, a division of Serpent's Tail, but is nausea and horror a correct response to the fiction, or is it like getting over a gag reflex? You have to get past that threshold.
Well, I think that, like, the actual, you know, nausea gag stuff is like the realistic thing that happens in the world, that really happens through the experiences, like seeing it or having it happen to you or something but I think in writing it's a lot different, and it's a much more cerebral thing. It's the safety, you know, you're in your little chair flipping pages, and or from my point of view, like sitting there writing it. And well, I like how there's sort of like a line you get like right on the middle, where there's, I don't want a straight kind of the moralizing of violence or something against it, or like these guys are bad. It's like really too obvious, and I'm also not interested in anything like, well, why are they doing it? You know, is there a way to stop them? I mean, you know, of course not. I mean, you know, I mean, it's like, what about the nausea of like, you know, the Greek tragedies or something? I mean, they were just like wailing on each other forever. And so, you know, it's like, it's, I mean, those are like the hairiest books in the world. And
well, I've always assumed, it's sort of funny, in the 60s, suddenly there was the presence of what was called black or dark comedy. And, you know, it went in a certain sense without saying that the horrific events in these stories were occasions to liberate a certain kind of writing energy. Something happened in the culture. It's almost as if, no matter what, people will find a way to be offended. And there seems, in all the years I've been reading, never to be so many justifications for being offended as there is right now to sexual violence. Does the offense animate the desire to write in that way?
No way, no. I mean, No, I don't want to. I'm not really thinking about who's reading things or who's going to respond to something, and I don't want to agitate anybody. I mean, I'm kind of, all of this thing is basically, it still gets back down to that original thing where it's just like sentences and like, how do I make this thing work? I might have a particular interest in certain subjects, you know, that I like to read about this kind of stuff. You know, I'm, you know, I want to be inside this kind of thing. It's really like very lively, and I think that I have an instinct toward, you know, I like being frightened. I kind of hate it, but I really am. It's sort of appealing. It's curious, and it's nice to sort of be able to sort of like live through it or survive in some way, or have, you know, I don't know.
Well, it's funny because I've never responded to them as frightening. Rather, I see them something like Little Nemo in Slumberland, except the Slumberland is modern. And instead of walking beds and sudden bombardments of dinosaurs and elephants, there's this parade of horrors, and it seems almost as if the joke is, what can be hurled next?
Yeah.
What in the kind of id or nightmare land can be the next obstacle? Sometimes they're hilarious for being small things, a dog eating a cookie, say, and sometimes they're hilarious for being the biggest monster imaginable.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, I want them. I think that they're mainly, you know, they're supposed to be funny. Or like, you know, through a lot of, you know, in the middle, I don't know, just a sort of, you know, odd mix of, you know, I don't want to be funny when I'm supposed to, and I don't want to be scary, I just don't want the prose to be, you know, predictable. But yeah, it starts to get giddy where, like, the more violent it gets, it just seems more and more kind of silly, or, you know, completely slapstick.
Can dreams be used in fiction?
Yeah.
Good. I've been speaking to Benjamin Weissman, the author most recently of Dear Dead Person. Thank you for joining me.
Okay, thanks.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.